It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
And of course, we've got Wes and Cecil here in the studio this morning. And gentlemen, good morning to you.
Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
Hey, Ben Lockwood.
Somebody got a compliment there. I'm not sure which one, but anyhow.
How are you, Lockwood? It's always a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you very much. Good morning to you guys. So what's on tap today?
Lockwood, we thought we would speak today about some of the changes that we see in the administration of estates and these changes are with our clerks of court here in Carteret, Onslow, Craven, Pamlico, Jones, some of the counties we deal in, that they are having to respond to the Administrative Office of Courts, the AOC.
Judicial Standards Commission. It might have been AOC.
Right.
Yeah, there was an audit last year over all of the counties in the state of North Carolina with regard to estate administration. And there was some direction given by the state of North Carolina to the various offices, the various courthouses, basically, and clerks of court as to certain standards that they must uphold regarding administration of estates. And that is something that is being implemented in 2016, and it's certainly affecting our practice and affecting the administration of estates.
So Lockwood, let's be more specific here. Historically, traditionally, after the executor is sworn in, mm-hmm. or the administrator, if there's no will, and they take what we know as the oath of office, and they affirm before the clerk that they are the administrator, they are the fiduciary, the executor, and that they will honor the North Carolina law, that they will marshal together the assets, pay the debts, and then distribute the assets appropriately. Historically and traditionally, this was what the executor would do. And then, of course, it was a matter of, it was as if at that point, that was somewhat the end of it, if you will, Lockwood, unless someone came forward and set forth an allegation or an affirmation, if you will, that, well, you know, gosh, there was $100,000 in the checking account, and now, you know, I didn't get my third.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's not going to happen anymore, because now what the requirement is that there be a statement attached to the accountings that show the date of death values in any accounts, mm-hmm. and all activity in those accounts until such time as those accounts are brought to zero.
Gotcha.
And supporting evidence.
Which means such things as
cancel checks.
Receipts.
Bank statements.
Bank statements. Okay.
Correct.
Right. Yeah.
Correct. So,
Let me interrupt you real quick. Was that not the case prior?
No, it was not.
No. Some counties did require that. I mean, you know, if you dealt with an estate, I would say Cumberland County was kind of like that. They had gotten that way. They would require account statements. Wake County was pretty much like that. Some of the smaller counties in eastern North Carolina were not. So basically.
So there wasn't standardization across the state?
No, not at all. And we see that from clerk to clerk's office anyway, to a certain extent. But nevertheless, you know, it was almost like the executor's word was good enough. And
well, and Lockwood, in all fairness,
I'm smiling.
If they sign off on it and say this is what happened, we believe you.
You've been colored, Lockwood, by our world. I can tell.
Well,
no, really,
just,
to be honest with you, it was exceedingly rare that there was a problem under the old, if you will, way. I mean, most executors are take the job very seriously. They come forward. They know what the accounts are. They divide them appropriately. They pay the bills. And of course, that is the end of it. Now, they always had to disclose what the value of the day-to-death value was, and they also had to disclose, of course, that it was divided three ways, two ways, however it was to be distributed. But the underlying evidence of this, the substantiation, if you will, would remain in the lawyer's file or in their file at home if they were doing this on their own without legal assistance, things of that nature. And now, of course, those attachments, those that substantiation is now required when we are making our filings with the clerks of court. This, of course, is an added burden greatly to the executor because, you know, sometimes these records are voluminous. They're large. Sometimes they are hard to get and to obtain. And so it is a bit of a rude awakening to some of the to not only new executors but actually to law firms that are now assisting many executors. The burden is greater than it has been in the past. Now I'd like to give Wes is going to give us a couple of examples, notwithstanding the fact, Lockwood, that it did for many by and large, most estates went pretty well. But you know, all it takes is a couple of bad apples. And then of course, you know, we respond to these bad apples. It's it's the same concept as our durable powers of attorney. You know, we've talked so many times on the program about the fact that, you know, the powers of attorney now have to be so very specific and so very detailed because banks have been stung, stock companies have been, you know, have been stung by the fact that people go in there with some sort of generic grant of authority. Then the principal gets better, says, well, how in the world did you allow my power of attorney to change all these accounts around? My power of attorney wasn't specific enough to give them that authority. You shouldn't have let them do that. And so in response to these exceptions to the rule, now the durable power of attorney standard has become quite onerous as well. But Wes is going to give us some examples that we have in our office currently pending where these new requirements of added substantiation really actually are beginning to kind of be worth their weight in gold in these situations where there's been some malfeasance.
And you say malfeasance or potential of it,
yes.
As we have.
Right, and you wonder, you know, how does this come about? How do you hear about these situations where maybe there was, some malfeasance with regard to the administration of an estate? You know, our best, you know, examples are true world examples, things we've dealt with. I mean, one that comes to mind that I've dealt with that's now resolved, dealt with an estate that was, my goodness, when it got to me, it was 10 years ago. Okay. And basically what happened was the administrator of the estate, conveniently, just in general, there's a lot of detail here, but let me kind of cut to it. Conveniently left out a distribution to a certain grandchild, you know, to the tune of about $100,000. And the grandchild, you know, of course, was a couple generations removed here. Grandmother had died in Carteret County, but didn't, receive this $100,000. So time went on, and this grandchild, you know, at the time, I think that the grandmother died, was probably in his 20s. So he's in his 30s when he contacts me. And, you know, we get into it and we find, my goodness, this executor kept the money, kept $100,000. So then you get into the question of, well, what can you do about it when so much time has passed? Well, there's several things. The claims that you bring with regard to that would be a claim for constructive fraud, which has a 10-year statute of limitations. So that's always very important. 10 years is pretty long statute of limitations in, you know, the world of litigation. And then a claim to impeach the accounting, meaning what you reported to the court was not accurate. So we're going to impeach that and require you to answer for where this money is. There's no statute of limitations on that. So that can be done at any point in time. And also, a claim to, really is kind of a quasi impeach the accounting type claim that also, is recognized in the law that basically allows you to question what was shown to the court as well. So there are three claims that really are normally seen. The best claim is a constructive fraud claim. So if we can deal with these issues within 10 years of when the estate was closed and the final accounting was signed off on, then that's always better. So, you know, obviously these were things that took place because this higher level of scrutiny was not required, you know, many years ago when this took place. In the event that we were living in a world at that point in time when where the clerk of court required the account statements and the check images and the actual evidence, which normally is going to come from, you know, the banking institution to show mm-hmm. how the money came right. in, how the money went out, and what money there was, what assets there were upon the death of the decedent, the testator, then the clerk of court can look at that pretty, you know, pretty quickly based on, you right. know, good record keeping and good information being provided to them and see, oh, this is all done right. I see evidence it was done right. Stamp of approval, close. Now what would happen in that same estate? What it would hit, it would stop, and a clerk would say, no, I can't close this out because you haven't given me this, this, all this, this, and this. Give me the evidence. Give me the background information. And then I will approve your accounting and approve your final. And that would have stopped, you know, this mistake that ended up, you know, shorting this grandchild $100,000, which by the way, ended up being more like $200,000 because of 10 years of interest.
That's what I was wondering. Was there any interest or punitive damages?
No punitives. There could have been punitives in that case. But we didn't focus so much on that. We think it was intentional and we think it was a conscious disregard of the rights of the grandchild. That's what you have to look at with regard to punitives. There could have been, but the case was resolved based on the actual amount and interest, which is 8% legal rate. Pretty good rate. 10 years. Here we are. The 100,000 ends up being 200,000.
All right, we're talking Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins here in a few moments. I got a couple of questions I want to ask you.
I've got a couple more cases for you.
I want to hear about those as well. you know, this does bring up a comment that as we pursue these conversations, taking an estate is not a casual issue.
No, it really isn't, Lockwood, we'll and see. It's becoming, you know, more and more burdensome for the executors.
We're going to continue this conversation. Stay with us. And, of course, you're welcome to call in if you have a question. Stay with us, Arden. We're talking Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, and they've got my attention this morning. Mm-hmm. I have handled several estates, and fortunately, I learned early on, document. And when I say everything, I mean everything.
Right.
not a penny that didn't spend or activity. Well,
one more requirement that, and then we'll talk some more practical examples here.
Wow.
We've talked so many times on this program, Lockwood, about, you know, joint accounts with right of survivorship at the bank.
Right.
Accounts that are payable on death. You know, this is just, I mean, I think our listeners know generally what I'm talking about, but it's so very popular now, these accounts that are either payable on death, time on death, or joint with right of survivorship.
Mm-hmm.
And, they get, established out in the practical world, in the real world, at banks, brokerage firms, et cetera. Well, historically, although these accounts were disclosed, it's required that they be disclosed, but they're disclosed under sections of the inventories and accountings that mm-hmm. say that they are with right of survivorship and that they therefore went to the survivor. Now, of course, the clerk is looking at the account registration, okay, the signature card at the bank that showed that the account was set up joint with right of survivorship. Sometimes we're unable to locate these cards.
So Cecil Harvell of West Collins comes in and says, we have all this documentation. They're saying, great, show me.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, normally the account statement would show JWROS, something like that, joint with right of survivorship. But what Cecil's saying is now you have to go back to the actual originating document when that account was opened up. that shows that this decedent actually signed for this to be a joint account. That's pretty onerous.
It is.
And a lot of times I agree. You can't get that document. Right. I mean, the account could have been opened 20 years ago. I mean, you just don't know.
My point to this, and I understand the criticality, love that word, of the situation. We're moving into one of the greatest periods of transition, baby boomers. There are a lot of estates that are, in one fashion or another, already having been developed. Mm-hmm. It would be time to say, let's go back and review this with an attorney to talk about this, because the problem's going to be for the survivors.
Right.
Trying to provide all this information.
That's right.
I apologize, I see this, I mean, you got my attention when you told me all this. We've got Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell here, by the way. And if you are interested in a question, we've got time. 910 area code 353-4674, 252 area code 247-7282. Back to the real world experiences. I apologize.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, one thing that we want our listeners to know, and just for it to be said on the radio, is that, you know, Cecil and I are really happy to see that there's this higher level of scrutiny. You know, it requires more work. It requires more organization. It requires more finding documentation.
But it's better to do it now than after the death.
Well, it's just better for the whole process.
Exactly.
Too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's better for the clients. It's better for the heirs. It's better for everyone just to go through this process. Now, you know, it does create litigation, you know, in the event that you don't have this higher level. So, you know, these are these stories I'm telling you about. These situations that have transpired over the years because of, you know, a lack of this higher level of scrutiny with regard to estate administration. And maybe sometimes you get into a situation where maybe the executor was just too casual. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes you get into a situation where it's more of a malfeasance, more of an intentional act. It just depends. I think that on the scenario that I talked about a moment ago, you know, one thing I didn't talk about there is that really – what it seemed happened with regard to that situation was that the executor, who retained the funds, who didn't disperse to the grandchild, there was really co-executors, Lockwood. So you had a brother and a sister who were serving as co-executors together. It appeared that the male co-executor, the brother, is the one who did the wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. But in the interim, he died. So guess who ended up paying the money to the grandchild out of the other one, the sister, the other co-executor. She is just as liable as he is, even though she did not receive potentially the money.
This comes from personal accounts? They have to come up with the
money? Absolutely. She just has to pay it. So, you know, it's a pretty powerful thing. If you're you're a fiduciary and you sign off on the final and the final's wrong, you're personally liable for that.
Yeah, the executor, Lockwood, is always personally liable, for any kind of, malfeasance. Again, the duty of the executor is to marshal together the assets, even if it's $10, pay the bills, even if it's $1, and distribute the other $9. And if you don't do that, if you don't follow that basic fundamental rule of gathering the assets, paying the debts, and distributing them according to law, then you, of course, can be held personally responsible. And that's exactly what Wes is talking about here. They gathered up the assets. They paid the bills, but they did not distribute them properly. The co-executor just assumed, you know, that her brother was appropriately, you know, handling the duties. He told her that I'll handle it. Well, he didn't. And of course, unfortunately, she then is left personally responsible.
All right. You're listening to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. And by the way, I can tell you right now, I'm paying close attention to this conversation because, as you plan your estates, the time to start working on that is right now, especially with this new scrutiny. Stay tuned. We've got more here coming up in just a moment here on Coastal Daybreak. All right, we're talking about estate management, and we've got Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell in the studio this morning, and I asked a question off air. It does vary from state to state how estates are handled.
Well, it absolutely does, and thank you for bringing that up, Lockwood. Death and dying, if you will, is one of the few areas of the law that is still left to the sovereignty of each state.
Okay.
It has generally not been federalized. The only part of that death and dying that's federalized, of course, is our good old Internal Revenue Service and the taxes that are attributable. But let me hasten to say, relative to that, you know, estates now that are not more than $5 million escape estate taxation. Okay. So it is exceedingly rare. A very tiny percentage of estates, really trigger the estate tax. And anyone worth $5 million or more is going to have the bright and shining tax lawyers work on that issue. So estate tax, more or less, even though it gets talked about a lot politically, it really is just a non-starter. There are very few dollars, okay, relatively speaking, going to our government for estate tax dollars because, again, very, very wealthy people plan around it,
right,
and most people don't have $5 million. And when I say $5 million, if you're married, like you are, Lockwood, then the bottom line is that's $10 million. Okay. So, but your question is about the sovereignty of the states, mm-hmm, other than this tax issue. The death and dying issues are left to each state. Some of these burdens that we're now seeing in North Carolina before our clerks of court, which as Wes just mentioned, are good, mm-hmm, new requirements, more substantiation, more communication. These are good things. These have, in all fairness, been in effect in some of your other more industrialized, okay, jurisdictions, Michigan, Illinois, New Jersey, New York. They've been in those states for a while where the burden was higher.
Mm-hmm.
It's now becoming higher in North Carolina.
And to that point, Wes, you were saying a few moments ago as we wrap it up, these details now are in a notebook with the clerks of court?
Right. Well, if you were to go sit down with the Carteret County Clerk of Court, for example, she has a nice white notebook, mm-hmm, that's just as pretty as can be, and she says, this is the way that I want it to appear to me. You open the notebook, it's chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, taking you right from the beginning of the estate to the end of the estate.
Correct.
If you take your documentation to the clerk in a disorganized fashion, even if you have everything there, bank statements, so on and so forth, she's going to give it right back to you and say, get it organized, put it together so that I can follow this quickly. They don't have the manpower to do the organization. They have a lot of estates to deal with, and there's very few clerks to deal with that.
The right advice at the right time, and the time is now. Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell, of course, of Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law. Phone number, 726-9050. That's 252 area code, 726-9050, 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City, or online at harvellandcollins.com.